Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the reading of a redacted version of the Constitution on the floor of the House today. And unlike the Republican congressman, unlike the Republican congressman who organized the reading, we will speak with a constitutional scholar who actually knows the Constitution, Dahlia Lithwick. We'll also discuss the forthcoming tutorial on the Constitution to be given by the new Congress, given to the new Congress by Supreme Court Justice Scalia at the invitation of the leader of the Tea Party caucus, Michelle Bachmann. Then we'll look into whether the ruling elite in Iran is becoming unglued. We already know that many are unhinged, but recent reports from WikiLeaks tell of the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the real power behind the throne, slapping President Ahmadinejad in the face. Dan Brunberg, a professor at Georgetown University who specializes in Iran, joins us to analyze the recent firing of Iran's foreign minister, the capture of a vulture the regime claims works for Mossad, and the arrest of an American woman accused of spying for America with a bugging device in her tooth. Then finally, we'll discuss the state of the state of California, now under new management, with the former deputy treasurer of the state of California, Mark Paul. We will assess whether there is a chance of restoring fiscal sanity, overturning Proposition 13, and surviving a hostile Congress in Washington that appears to want to force California into bankruptcy and break the public employee unions. I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's already a storm of controversy surrounding Justice Scalia from his recent remarks that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause doesn't extend to women. But let's begin discussing his upcoming trip to Capitol Hill at the invitation of one of the Tea Party leaders in the House, Representative Michelle Bachmann. Does that strike you as a little bit crossing the line? I mean, we always talk about the separation of powers. I'm beginning to wonder how separate these powers are between the conservatives on the Supreme Court and the Republican Party.
Well, you'll be charmed to hear that the topic of Justice Scalia's upcoming speech to the Tea Party folks is, in fact, quote, the separation of powers. So if irony makes your head explode, then that's his topic. It's a very interesting problem. I don't think that there's anything necessarily wrong with Supreme Court justices being asked to, I guess in this case it's being framed as he's teaching a class on the Constitution, and Michelle Bachmann has gone out of her way to say that even though the Tea Party has organized this, it's certainly open to anyone who wants to come and attend and learn.
So you mean all those representatives she calls socialists and communists?
Exactly.
So
I see. Certainly going out of her way to say that this is open to anyone, and the Supreme Court is going out of its way to say, you know, justices should be allowed to go speak to anyone. You know, they can go to law schools and they can go speak at the Federalist Society, so why shouldn't they go speak to the Congress? You know, it does become, as a matter of sort of political symbolism, very fraught, because we're looking at a House of Representatives that, you know, is reading the Constitution from the House floor, kind of purporting to suddenly have discovered the Constitution after, you know, decades of neglect, and they are for the first time really going to drill down and understand the Constitution. Michelle Bachmann sort of likens it to being in training. You know, they're going to go to this coach and he's going to teach them how it's done. And all that is very problematic, because I think it lends credence to the idea, first and foremost, that prior legislators were not adhering to the Constitution, and that certainly, I think, the Tea Party message, you know, the message is that the Congress has overreached massively and vastly, you know, expanded its powers beyond the Constitution. And so for the first time, if they read it, maybe they can check themselves. And so this is of a piece with this sentiment that we're going to get square on the Constitution. And then it becomes problematic, because there's a real question about whether just one justice in his view of the Constitution is all that they should be learning.
Well, we'll hold our breath, Dahlia Lithwick, to see who shows up, and whether the un-American congressmen show up on January the 24th. But, of course, the reading today of the Constitution, they alternated. At one point, actually, it was a Democrat reading the 14th Amendment, and when a teabagger protested and had to be ejected on the basis that when he read the piece about people born in the only people born in the United States can become president of the United States. So yeah. That was today's hijinks.
You know, today was, I thought, very, very problematic for other reasons. One, you know, it is true. It was certainly bipartisan reading of the Constitution. But I thought what was most interesting today, Ian, was that they read what they called a redacted or amended Constitution. In other words, the same Tea Party that has purported to be wanting to, you know, restore fealty and respect for the Constitution got up and read part of it today. And, you know, the comments that were made, I mean, this was raised as a question on the House floor even before they began to read the Constitution. And Virginia Republican Bob Goodlatte, who is sort of shepherding this whole enterprise, said, oh, you know, I checked with the Congressional Research Service and the Library of Congress, and they say that there's this redacted copy of the Constitution. There is this amended Constitution, and that's what they're going to read. And then they went on to, you know, leave out all the three-fifths stuff about, you know, African-Americans being three-fifths of a person, and they left out the 18th Amendment. So they picked and chose, and there's no official redacted version of the Constitution. There's a Constitution, and the three-fifths language is still there. It was never erased, and I think it's extremely fraught proposition for the Tea Party folks to say, we want to restore the Constitution and then read only bits of it that you like.
And Representative Goodlatte was recently on Lawrence O'Donnell's program on MSNBC, where he exhibited a very, very hazy understanding of the very Constitution that he is leading the reading of. Two congressmen, of course, one of whom, Sessions from New York, went to the floor to introduce the bill to overturn and repeal the health care laws. He turned out he hadn't been properly sworn in because he was at a fundraiser. So already, I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but already there's some major, major kind of questions about, I don't know about the priorities of some of these people, but the education of some of these people about the very, you know, if you don't know the Constitution, you don't know the House rules. You know?
That's right, and I think it's really, again, you know, as a matter of symbolism, to drape yourself in the Constitution, to say everything that is wrong with America is a function of our drifting away from the Constitution, and then as one of your first legislative acts to try to gut the 14th Amendment, you know, you sort of, I remember, you know, a con law teacher once teaching me, you can't sort of suck and blow. It is what it is. And if you're for the Constitution, you're for all of it. And if you want to amend it, go ahead and amend it. But I don't think what you get to do is, you know, read selectively or revere it to the point of near, I think, biblical reverence, and then at the same time say, you know, we're going to go through with our red pen and gut everything that doesn't jibe with our policy program. And I think that's really the danger of this current, you know, constitutional fervor, is that it's not constitutional fervor. It's fervor for some of the Constitution, and I think that's just disingenuous in the extreme.
And it can't be dismissed as the Reader's Digest version of the Constitution. It seems like a very selective one. So, again, I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the Supreme Court and judicial issues for Newsweek and Slate. Now, being an originalist, as Justice Scalia is often described, and I imagine he feels that way, I just don't get it. By the way, there's an op-ed in today's LA Times talking about Scalia's right to speak. I don't know that anybody ever questioned his right to speak. It's just a question, I think, about the separation of powers here. But let's just touch on this, on what seems to be extraordinary to me, Dahlia, and that is that, am I right in suggesting that he has said recently in California, Scalia, that the Equal Protection Clause, which I believe was intentionally broad, because its purpose was to ensure a fairer society. He was saying that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment doesn't necessarily apply to women, and that's half of our population. At the same time, I believe he and others, fellow conservatives on the court, believe that the 14th Amendment applies to corporations, and of course that law was what the Supreme Court ruling was passed in the 19th century. So am I right in wondering what kind of priorities they are, where you don't extend rights to women, but you do to corporations?
Well, I think one thing that I find really interesting about this current kerfuffle about Scalia and the 14th Amendment is that he said exactly the same thing in a talk in September. So he's at least consistent in his very narrow reading of the Constitution. I mean, what he says is that, you know, the Reconstruction Amendments were passed to protect African Americans, not women, not homosexuals. And if you, America, want to explicitly protect women and homosexuals, pass more amendments. And so he's reading it, you know, in vintage Scalia fashion, completely narrowly and as, you know, in a crabbed as fashion as he can. So this isn't new. This is how he likes to read laws. You're quite right that the Citizens United decision, you know, opted to give First Amendment rights to corporations. So there is some real question about how it is that we can be so broad and so expansive at the same time. But this is really classic Scalia. I mean, I think that it's not just interesting insofar as he has a very, very cramped notion of who is protected and a very, very, I think, ambitious notion of how easy it would be to pass something like the Equal Rights Amendment, which, as you know, we couldn't pass. So I think he's both, you know, very sort of narrow in his constitutional construction and very, very aspirational in his idea of how we modify the Constitution in this country. But I think this is just of a piece with how Scalia talks. He likes to be bombastic. He likes to be sort of the bad boy. He likes to draw this kind of attention to himself. And I think he is loving the publicity he's getting right now. So this is, you know, he's a very, very funny character. He's been talking like this for decades. I'm going to frankly miss him when he retires someday, because there's no one on the court who sort of walks the walk and talks the talk as much as he does. But certainly I think if, you know, your underlying question is, do we have a court that is just freakishly inclined to invent new rights to protect corporate interests at the same time that they are systematically making it harder and harder for ordinary Americans to vindicate their rights in the court, there's no question, and it's very, very, very worrisome.
Well, as you know, Dahlia Lithwick, Justice Stevens had some vigorous dissent over Citizens United, and he was recently on 60 Minutes. Apparently there's more of that interview to come, but what struck me most about Justice Stevens reflecting on his years on the court and what bothered him about the changes on the court, and you know he also has revealed what he thinks happened about capital punishment, where they didn't expect it to go as far as it has gone. But I was struck by what he said about what happened over Bush v. Gore, and getting to this idea of the separation of powers in this country, and whether or not you have four, you know, right-wing conservatives on the court who may well, you know, basically, I don't know whether in collusion with the Republican Party, but they certainly seem to act on behalf of the Republican Party. Stevens was completely blindsided that they even took that case up, because it was such obviously a states' rights case, and there was no he didn't even think that it would get past first base. But then he found out that the Scalia and company not only were going to take it, but they already had their minds made up.
I think that one of the most important things that Justice Stevens has said in the last couple of years, and it's the thing that we forget or we don't remember to listen to, is that with the possible exception of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, every single person on the court in the last 30 years who has retired has been replaced by someone not just to their right, but quite dramatically to their right. And that what it was once, you know, the sort of moderate center of the court is now the left, and what was once the far right of the court is now the center, and there is this new dramatically far right to the court that was unanticipated when he joined the court. In other words, the center of gravity has shifted so dramatically on the Supreme Court that, you know, it is unrecognizable to him as the court that he joined. And, you know, he has said as much in dissent over the years. But I think that for Stevens, you know, when he's asked, you know, how did you move to the left over your career, his answer has consistently been, I've moved nowhere. The court has absolutely moved around me. And I think that Bush v. Gore is an example, as you said. His views of what's happened in the death penalty cases, you know, I think he really has been shocked to see how changes in the composition of the court and a real rightward tilt in appointments and confirmations in the court have affected constitutional law. It's been, I think, very, very dispiriting for him to see something, an institution that he thought was one thing, become something he almost doesn't recognize.
Well, again, Dahlia Lithwick, I'm trying to sort of to find the line here between right-wing ideology and political partisanship, because the effects of Citizens United have been dramatic. We've seen an extremely right-wing group of representatives get elected to the House and the Congress, to the House and the Senate, and we've seen enormous amounts of money spent by front groups who have protected the sources of this money and disguised the sources of this money. And this can only continue in the future. There's no symmetry between the money that labor unions have and the money that corporations have. So I don't know where the legal justification for this ruling is, but I sure as hell know what the political outcome has been.
Well, and you know, one of the real cornerstones to Citizens United, I mean, the key to understanding Justice Kennedy's, you know, decisive fifth vote is that Justice Kennedy said, you know, this won't work unless we have disclosure, unless we have full and open disclosure. And now you're seeing, since Citizens United, a concerted effort to prevent disclosure. So I think one of the things that's really interesting, it both highlights, I think, how naive Justice Kennedy was about believing that disclosure was going to continue to keep the system honest, but also that, you know, on the heels of that triumphant victory, the next move was, and now, you know, if the rules are unconstitutional, we're going to make sure that the disclosure rules are also unconstitutional. So I think you're quite right that, you know, the trend is always to sort of pick up a victory and run harder to the right and make it even more in the interest of big corporations to make sure that their, you know, voices being heard at the court. Citizens United is a really good example of how a sea change happened immediately in the wake of that decision. And America sort of looked around and said, you know, we hated that decision, and yet still we can't pass rules that would provide for, you know, real disclosure.
But, Dahlia, they start very narrow with, like they did with the D.C. gun law, and then blew that out into a radical reinterpretation of the Second Amendment. In this case, the documentary, Hillary the Movie, incidentally, was made by a guy who was the chief investigator for Dan Burton when he held a kind of witch hunt committee looking into Clinton and whether or not Clinton killed his best friend, Vince Foster. And they had this poor, hapless attorney general in jail, Webb Hubble. And this guy re-edited the prison tape interviews and conversations of Webb Hubble to incriminate him. He was fired by Dan Burton, believe it or not, for what he did. And he ends up making this movie that ends up being the basis of this monumental shift in how American elections take place and who finances them and whether these people are accountable and identifiable. So, again, I see a thread in political partisanship here that is really disturbing. I mean, not just partisanship, zealous political partisanship.
And in this particular case, the court could have resolved it a year earlier on this very, very narrow question of these pay-per-view movies. In other words, you know, this was a very narrow question that could have been confined to Hillary the Movie. And the idea that this minimalist, humble, you know, simple umpire, balls and strikes court reached out and said, you know what? While this is in front of us, why don't we just revisit all of our precedent in all of our campaign finance law? was, I think, one of the most aggressive and sort of overreaching acts I've ever seen in the court. So I think you're quite right. You know, this was an example of the court that purports to be, you know, only limiting itself to the narrowest thing it can decide, reaching way beyond the confines of this case to, you know, more or less eviscerate decades of campaign finance law. So I think it really, you know, it puts the lie to that word activist. You know, we have this idea that courts are only activists when they reach liberal results. This was one of the most activist acts I have ever seen committed, you know, including possibly Bush v. Gore, in that the court went way beyond what it needed to do, way beyond its mandate, and decided something that wasn't even properly before it.
But you suggested earlier that there are some people on the court, Scalia and the cadre of ultra-conservatives, who had their eye on the ball, and somehow they got this fifth vote from Kennedy, who was a little naive and didn't realize the full scope of it. So I guess we'll leave it at that, but I'm always troubled by constitutional nostalgia just as much as this nostalgia that Glenn Beck and others evoke for a simpler America. What that's a code for is the white Aussie inherited America when blacks and Hispanics were invisible, and we know that the Constitution was basically written for white men only. Is that – do you think there's a thread of this kind of nostalgia that's in a lot of these rulings, or am I being a little unfair here?
Well, I don't know how much of that is in the rulings. I know certainly, you know, there's a lot of anger on the part of some of the more conservative justices about what they feel is an America that, you know, is so devoted to affirmative action that a white man can't get a fair shake. Chief Justice John Roberts famously wrote in an opinion about voluntary desegregation in school programs in Seattle that the only way to get beyond race is to get beyond race, and likened, you know, voluntary busing to try to integrate schools to the kind of discrimination that we saw in the Jim Crow South. So I think the idea that you could even analogize, you know, attempts to make schools that are segregated because of residential housing patterns, that you're trying to make those a little bit more racially mixed, is somehow analogous to Jim Crow segregation in the schools, I think shows that there is this filament of, wow, you know, we have really, really been worked over as white guys, and, you know, it's gone way too far. But I will say, I think, in addition, that some of this Tea Party fondness for the Constitution and for restoring states' rights, and now this new amazing repeal amendment that is gaining momentum that would allow two-thirds of the states to veto acts of Congress, this sort of nostalgia for the idea that states are disenfranchised and that states have, you know, states are people too and they have all sorts of rights, really is reminiscent of some of, you know, the real ugliness we saw in the civil rights era. I was on another radio show yesterday, and a caller called in and said, you know, states' rights people, the 60s are calling, and they say, stop it. You know, and I think there is this feeling that the last time we heard this kind of bombastic screaming about how states need to have their rights restored, it was to effect really, really ugly purposes in this country.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dahlia Lithwick.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Let's take a brief station break, and then we'll be back talking about whether the regime inside of Iran is becoming unhinged. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Dan Brunberg, who's a professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and also serves as a special advisor for the United States Institute for Peace's Muslim World Initiative, where he focuses on democratization and political reform in the Middle East and wider Islamic world. He has authored and edited numerous books and articles, including Conflict, Identity, and Reform in the Muslim World and Reinventing Khomeini, the Struggle for Reform in Iran. And already there's evidence that within the elite that some of them are a little unhinged, but now it looks as like the regime itself may be coming unglued. WikiLeaks is reporting that the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps slapped Ahmadinejad in the face because he wanted more liberalization of the press in order to put down the demonstrations. And the head of the IRGC, Muhammad Ali Jafari, slapped him in the face and said, you're wrong. You created this mess. So what are we to make from that?
Well, I mean, there has been disputes within the regime. Even when after Ahmadinejad was elected for the first time in 2005. So in some respects, this is not a new story. These tensions within the regime became worse, widened, and escalated after the repression of the Green Movement in June 2009, having excluded most of the urban kind of middle class from politics. The regime has left to sort of fight among themselves. And I think Jafari, the head of the Revolutionary Guard, in fact, had a point when he chastised the president for being essentially a hypocrite, because now suddenly Ahmadinejad, worried about his own popularity, is criticizing the repression of the opposition, whereas, as Jafari himself correctly pointed out, it was the Iranian president who presided over that very process of repression and helped to instigate it, along with the Revolutionary Guards, in June and July of 2009. So there's more hypocrisy to go around for everyone. And this is ultimately a story of jockeying for power among different elements of the regime. All are wed to one another by a marriage of convenience, and all of whom pretend to sort of get along, but all of whom are constantly looking behind their backs, distrustful of the other one.
Well, you recall, Dan Brumberg, there was a period during the Reagan administration when we were looking for Iranian moderates, when Oliver North and company went over there with a cake, etc. And it feels like we're back visiting that idea, whether there's any moderation within the top reaches. It doesn't seem that way with the IRGC, the Guards Corps, and the Basijian militias. I mean, arguably, they fit the definition that has essentially been, I think, discredited by our neocons, that they're Islamo-fascists.
Well, I have great concerns with those sorts of terms, but I would certainly say that this is a very hard line of power-hungry political elites who believe that day has come and have reached the top of the greasy pole and now are trying to exclude each other. But it is also the case that in the process of doing that, they have undermined the more pragmatic, mainstream conservative political elite who helped to create the revolution, and particularly the drive to control the economy through what looks like or what purports to be a process of privatization, but really is a way of Ahmadinejad and his allies to line their own pockets, have alienated important members of the clerical political elite as well as the mainstream conservative elite. Whether we wish to call them moderate or not, the fact of the matter is that they aren't happy with many of the actions of their president, and whether they do or do not provide an opportunity for negotiations or might, under certain conditions, support negotiations with the U.S. is an interesting question. But terms such as moderate and extreme are very difficult to sort of fathom in this context of this vicious power struggle.
Well, I suppose what is clear about the legacy of the neocons is that their misadventure in Iraq has truly strengthened this regime in Iran. The fact that Sadr, the cleric, just returned to Iraq from Iran as an important player, and the more that you learn about what's going on in Iraq today, the more it looks like Iran is the winner of the Iraq war.
Well, that is true, and not only have the Iranian regime benefited from the situation in Iraq to extend its influence in Iraq, and of course has extended its influence considerably in Lebanon, but the Iranian elite in and around Ahmadinejad has been very adept at extending a whole series of relationships with a whole diverse network of countries, including Brazil and Turkey and Venezuela, to some extent Russia and China. They see themselves as succeeding in helping to create a kind of alternative pole to Western political power and to promoting a process of competition in the global arena, which is constraining U.S. power. And I think that whether or not this is true or not, and this is a matter of considerable debate, certainly the leaders, including the Iranian president, tell themselves this story. They believe they have a success story, and that really has tended to increase their sense of power and that they can hold on, and that whatever their own internal divergences and tensions, they are united in their determination to thwart U.S. power and, of course, to undermine and isolate the political opposition. So it would be dangerous to assume that evidence of internal struggle within the regime is in any sense an indication that this regime is about to splinter or to become unglued or to fall apart, to fragment, or to not exercise considerable influence in the region. The Iranian regime looks to us often isolated, and we tell ourselves that success story, but from the perception of those in power in the regime itself, they are riding a wave.
Again, I'm speaking with Georgetown Professor Dan Brumberg, who's also a special advisor for the United States Institutes of Peace's Muslim World Initiative. We're talking about whether or not the regime in Iran is becoming unglued. The foreign minister was fired in a way that suggested that, at least to me. What's your reading on that?
Well, I've twice been to meetings with the Iranian president during which Mottaki was president, in New York, and said not a word. It was always clear to me from that small anecdotal experience, but from reports elsewhere, that Mottaki was a kind of dress foreign minister. He tried to exercise influence and hasn't done so in a long time. Now that doesn't mean that the president of Iran is calling the shots. I think ultimately it's the supreme leader, Khamenei, who calls the shots. But certainly there was tension between Mottaki, the foreign minister, and the Iranian president, who believed that he couldn't trust Mottaki, and that Mottaki represented the more mainstream conservative elite. And I think that in many ways is true. And now he's been pushed out of office, and it gives, at least for the moment, another possible victory to the Iranian president.
I understand, though, Dan Brumberg, that now that they've had to raise prices on gasoline, which is heavily subsidized, and other commodities, basic commodities, that the people are getting even more fed up with this regime. But, of course, we know from what happened to the Green Movement that they simply don't have the power and that the state has tremendous tools of repression. So where do we stand on the notion that the Bazaaris and may get together with the Green Movement and force their hand of this regime? Or you're suggesting earlier that we're kidding ourselves if we think they're falling apart.
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, there has been an escalation of various kinds of social protests within the urban middle class and lower middle classes, but we are now, and has accelerated since June 2009, teachers and drivers and bus drivers and workers of different kinds, and these have escalated. But none of this, there's no evidence that there is a kind of cross-class coalition led by a political leader who can pull these disparate groups together, and not only pull them together, but as you quite correctly pointed out, attracts support from the urban conservative mercantile class, the commercial class, in ways that would really affect the coherence of the regime. There was last year there were protests from the bazaar against proposed tax increases. The regime reduced greatly the percentage that they threatened to increase, and in so doing, it could be said that they mollified the bazaar and provided less impetus for the Bazaaris to align themselves with the professional middle class and the workers and the urban poor, those groups that have been protesting. So you have a disparate feel. Different social groups are unhappy, and the reduction of subsidies has exacerbated this problem, and there are many members of the middle class who depended on these gas subsidies. If you would drive around Tehran for a day or even half a day, you would notice that there are these private independent taxis, which are essentially individuals who drive around their cars and offer rides to other people at low cost, and that whole business thrived on subsidies, and that has basically been shut down now. There's been a severe drop in consumption of gas. How long that will last, we don't know. But we also know that Ahmadinejad and his allies are probably pretty adept at channeling a lot of the savings from this reduction of subsidies to their own bank accounts. So what looks to us from the outside, again, is an example of the regime sort of forced to take measures which undermine its credibility, which is to some extent true. At the same time, is a dynamic that the regime is trying to use to enrich its own pockets. And again, it's not necessarily going to provide the basis of instability or fragmentation, on the one hand from above, or the unity from below that some would otherwise imagine.
So, Dan Brunberg, given this recent spate of what to many of us seems ludicrous and comical and absurd, starting with Iran's reaction to the WikiLeaks, where through the Hezbollah papers and others, they've tried to put out the line that Julian Assange is a Mossad agent and the WikiLeaks cables are an invention of the Mossad, which, you know, only, I imagine, I mean, there are gullible people over here who believe that kind of stuff. But I wonder if how many people inside Iran believe the idea that this vulture that they captured with a transmitter saying "Made in Israel" on it. I mean, God, if the Mossad's going to send a vulture, at least they'd take the "Made in Israel" sign off the transmitter. But I mean, and then now this American woman captured with supposedly with a bug implanted in her tooth. As silly as it seems, there is a real side. There are a couple of hikers, American hikers, who are being held purely for ransom. They have no intelligence connections. At least that would seem to be the case. But these other ones are absurd. So, does this play well? I thought that there was a fairly educated, you know, group of Iranians, a substantial middle class. I mean,
you're absolutely right. It's this middle class. This amorphous middle class, which grew up under the umbrella of an expanded education system in the 80s and 90s, which has been, in essence, revolting against the regime, and the regime is trying to suppress it. And I would say that the members of the Green Movement and the opposition who are affiliated with this broad social class, and it's not in any sense a homogeneous class, most of them would laugh at the regime's claims and attach no credibility to them whatsoever. But then you have to look at the political and social roots of the rising political elite around Ahmadinejad, one that has very little exposure to Western education, many of whose roots are in the countryside, and who thrive on these sorts of on conspiracy theories that you and I would think are patently absurd, but are believed to be true by many of the people, including the president himself. So it does play well among a certain constituency, and spewing this sort of these crazy conspiracy theories also helps to sort of recharge the sort of ideological batteries of the regime. So it looks from the outside to be a totally absurd gambit, and from the inside, it is for some absurd and others perfectly true, and that's the reality of an Iranian society which is deeply divided.
So, Dan Brunberg, if this regime is to last, and if the Green Movement has been effectively suppressed, that's not to say that there are lots of seething people who can't stand it, both in the diaspora and within the country itself, and they don't like the isolation and the embarrassment that this regime is bringing them. But on the other hand, when we were talking earlier about how Muqtada Sadr, the anti-U.S. cleric, just returned to Iraq from Iran, where he's been in exile, and the extent to which the Iranians seem to have enormous influence over this Iraqi government that we've put into power, I get the impression that Iran may end up having tremendous influence over Iraq. And once Iraq gets on its feet and starts pumping oil, I'm wondering whether that's going to make Iran stronger, not to mention Iraq.
Well, of course, once Iraq starts to pump oil, there'll be more supply.
That's true.
That, of course, is not something that necessarily the Iranians would wish to happen. But I think your larger point is correct, and that is that they're going to have a very close friend in Baghdad. They already do. But I would also caution people who study Iraq and Iraq's Shia communities much more closely than I tend to argue that too close an embrace between Iran and Iraq will could backfire on Iran. That the Iraqis are still Arabs. They have their own nationalist agenda. The coherence of Iraq is still important, certainly to the Arab both Sunni and Shia. They have profound differences, but an effort of Iran to sort of turn Iraq simply into a kind of colony of Iran could easily provoke a kind of backlash and could undermine Maliki's legitimacy. So I think what the Iraqis want and the government want is all the benefits of a close relationship with Iran and not the liabilities. And it's not always going to be easy to keep that balance.
But do you think people inside Iran, they must have learned from WikiLeaks that the Saudi leaders and the Arab leaders in the neighborhood are urging the Americans and the Israelis to get rid of the regime in Iran?
Well, that links up to your former point mm-hmm. about conspiracy theories. I think that for the Iranian regime, there's a serious perception that this is a manipulation of the U.S. government meant to demonstrate a kind of broad coalition of among the Arab, particularly the Gulf states, against Iran. And they probably do feel that it's a kind of contrivance, which, of course, is ridiculous. We know that the Arab leaders in the Gulf try to mollify Iran with relatively moderate language, but behind closed doors, they have expressed great consternation about Iranian power. The Iranians would like to believe otherwise, but it's certainly the case that the Gulf states feel very concerned about Iran's increasing leverage in the region.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Los Angeles, Dan Brumberg.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Dan Brumberg, who is a professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and the author of Reinventing Khomeini, The Struggle for Reform in Iran. He also serves as a special advisor for the United States Institute for Peace's Muslim World Initiative, where he focuses on democratization and political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the state of California. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Mark Paul, co-author of the book California Crack-Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. Mark Paul is a senior scholar and deputy director of the California Program at the New America Foundation. He was formerly national editor and editorial page editor of the Oakland Tribune and deputy editorial page editor and columnist at the Sacramento Bee. In 2004, Mr. Paul was appointed deputy treasurer of the state of California. He served as policy director for the treasurer's office and executive secretary of the state's Pooled Money Investment Board, which manages the cash reserves of state and local governments. He also oversaw the operations of the state financing authority for health and pollution control facilities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Paul.
It's good to be here, Ian.
And the governor's already met with a number of state and local officials on Tuesday morning. And after the meeting, he said that Proposition 13 took away the power of counties to tax. For the most part, it sent the decisions up to Sacramento, so we want to redistribute all of that. Can he undo Prop 13 through this empowering these local government officials?
Well, he can't do it directly, and neither can the legislature. It would the big lift of changing a lot of the Proposition 13 rules would require the voters to get involved as well. But he has certainly identified one of the really key problems in California is contributing to the budget crisis, this centralization of authority in Sacramento, and with and the separation of taxing and spending responsibility at the local government level, which has encouraged in local governments irresponsibility, because it's very easy to spend when you're not responsible for actually having to raise the money that you want to spend.
Of course, ironically, after Prop 13 passed, Jerry Brown, in his first term, signed a measure to protect schools from the loss of property taxes. making them dependent on the state for funding, and therein lies a long, sorry tale, right?
Well, exactly. And it was not just schools, but it was other local governments. One of the most important things about Proposition 13, which is, you know, which people don't think about, because when they hear the word term Prop 13, they think about the limits on property tax. But included in that measure was, in addition to capping and limiting property taxes, it then said, gave the responsibility to the legislature to take the remaining property tax dollars and decide how they should be distributed among cities, school districts, counties, special districts, et cetera. And so Prop 13 quite explicitly moved that decision to Sacramento, and the state not only made the decision about how the remaining money should be divvied up, but it also started backfilling some of the lost tax revenue from the Proposition 13 property tax cuts. And so we've created a situation right now in California, which, for instance, among the states, California has very high levels of local government spending, but it also has among the lowest levels of local government taxes. And the difference has been made up over the last 30 years out of state tax revenues and out of from programs that the state would otherwise be supporting, like the university systems. And so this is at the heart of California's budgeting dysfunction, is this system in which the money is spent fairly freely locally, but the local officials are not themselves responsible for actually having to raise those dollars. So what Brown is moving us toward is at least a discussion about whether or not we ought to restore taxing and spending authority in one place in local governments and make communities responsible for making their own decisions.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Paul, Deputy Director of the California Program at the New America Foundation and co-author of California Crack Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. And given the title of your book, obviously the questions are whether there's any fiscal sanity being restored from the recent election, either in the form of the new governor or in the form of some of the propositions, many of which appear to be contradictory. Now, so far, Governor has called for a 7% cut in the size of his staff, which is hardly going to do anything to the $28.5 billion deficit. But he hasn't appointed a chief of staff. His wife is special counsel with $0 for a salary. And then there's this other fellow that people seem to think is significant, James Hume. So he's not being hired as a chief of staff. So and other people, Mary Nichols and Bill Honig have also been hired. How's he going to run? I mean, does that mean that his wife's going to run be his right hand?
Well, I think everybody agrees that she's one of his most influential advisors. But Brown didn't have a chief of staff when he was governor previously. He called the sort of the central role executive secretary. Gray Davis had that job for part of the time, and actually it was shared. So Jim Hume and Nancy McFadden, they're both sort of named executive secretary. I think they're going to share that. It sounds like they're going to share that responsibility. But the chief of staff is something that came after Jerry, and I think he's more comfortable. It sounds like he's more comfortable with the arrangement he had when he was governor before.
Well, when he was governor before that, he was so busy running for president.
Well, some of the time, yeah.
Some of the time that Gray Davis did an awful lot of the work.
Right.
So then let's turn to that, to whether or not there is any way to bring some fiscal sanity here, given that the title of your book is California Crack Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State. We all know that story. But the how it can be fixed part of your title of your book is a big question. Are you optimistic in any way?
Well, the only thing that makes me optimistic is that you know, in going around the state and talking about these issues. I think that lots of Californians understand that we have broken our system of government fundamentally, and they in the election it was pretty clear that nobody was investing much hope in either of the two gubernatorial candidates that would make a fundamental difference. But I think that a discussion has started in the state over these things, and I think that it's a good sign that the governor is willing to confront this whole issue of the centralization of power in Sacramento. I mean, that is one of the pieces of what we need to change. But I think that we will see. You've already seen in the reaction to his, in the first 2 days, the reaction among some of the vested groups, including, local governments. I mean, local government officials are not, I think, going to easily give up this ride that they've had.
The free ride, where they get the money without the responsibility of making tough choices.
Exactly. I mean, it's not something that they're going to want to give up, and they have politically been relatively successful because the term local government evokes very warm and fuzzy thoughts in people frequently around the state. It's like you're talking about puppies, but in fact, if you look across California, most of the areas that I would identify as the least justifiable spending that goes on in the state and the inefficiency that goes on is at the local government levels, whether you're talking about the salaries of executives in local government, which are far, far higher than anything in state government, or the pay and pensions of public safety workers in local governments, or this great multiplicity of duplicated governments we have. In California, we have more than 7,000 elected governments in the state, if you count all the cities and counties and local government. And if we were to govern ourselves well and efficiently and be able to deal with our problems, there needs to be a lot of rethinking about and consolidation of those governments. And the fiscal crisis, in fact, I think we're seeing a little of that starting to happen just because of the economic realities of local government in these days. We've seen cities giving up their a couple of towns like Maywood in the south and a town in the Bay Area have given up their own police forces, for instance, because they can't afford them anymore.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Paul, who served as Deputy Treasurer of the State of California. Mark, in the 112th Congress is shaping up to be a major battle over the main political economic battle going on now is stimulus versus deficits, and the deficit hawks seem to have their way. Big part of the stimulus that President Obama managed to get through gave a lot of the states money, including California, to pay teachers and firemen, largely because of the revenue collapse resulting from the meltdown on Wall Street. However, that has been translated by Republicans into the states have spent too much money. I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes piece with Governor Christie implying that that Illinois and California have been profligate, no mention of the revenue collapse. A lot of people, including myself, think that this is a campaign on the part of the ideologues in the Republican Party just coming into power to essentially break the public employee unions and to engage in a kind of class warfare where they divide the working class between those in the private sector who've lost their jobs and pensions and health care with those in the public sector who have pensions and health care. And that's, to me, a very unpleasant thing to look forward to. Do you think I'm correct in seeing this?
Well, certainly, I think you're correct in that the Congress, particularly the House, is no longer, at least in the short term, going to be in the mood to help the states get through their continuing budget crises. Revenues have collapsed all across the country. because of the collapse of the housing bubble. The states that are dependent on things like sales tax and property tax have seen their collections go down. And in fact, a lot of states are, you know, in measured in proportional terms in even worse shape than California is. Our neighbors Arizona and Nevada, I think, are both in that case, in that situation. There doesn't seem at this point to be any sympathy to help the states through these things. So I think in California we're going to be on our own in working our way through these budget problems this year, and it's very difficult. I mean, this is a reckoning both with how deep the recession was and with how badly in California we have broken our system. These things are unfortunately coming together, you know, at the same time, and it's really a very difficult and unpleasant situation for everybody. I think, and that's why I know for people who might have seen Jerry Brown taking the oath of office, when he was asked, you know, during the oath whether he was accepting the obligation with no mental reservation, the audience laughed before he even had a chance to speak,
sure.
Because I think everybody understands, you know, how difficult his task is.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing today, Mark Paul.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Paul, co-author of the book California Crack-Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. He's a senior scholar and deputy director of the California Program at the New America Foundation, has been an editor at the Oakland Tribune and the Sacramento Bee, and served as deputy treasurer of the state of California. This has been Background Briefing. You may learn more about the program, listen to our archives, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and engineer Ray Palliez. And I'll be back on Sunday morning at 11 a.m. with another edition of Background Briefing. Until then, have a very pleasant couple of days, and bye. A lady dressed in white with a man.